This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today on the show, we'll talk to the novelist Michael Chabon, and we'll spend some quality time in Alaska without once mentioning Sarah Palin. That's just the kind of show we are. Back in the late 70s and 80s, the Police sold out stadiums all over the world, went multi-platinum, and introduced the world to the former school teacher called Sting. But behind the success of the Police was also the guy keeping time, Stuart Copeland. Copeland is a drummer's drummer who's gone on to write film scores and opera and lots more. So how can it have possibly taken him this long to write a memoir? The book is called Strange Things Happen, and Stuart Copeland joins me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Well, thank you very much.
So tell me about the title of your book, the lovely title, which is Strange Things Happen. Tell me everything you're referring to by that title.
Well, sports stars, politicians, and pop stars all experience the same strange phenomenon. Nobody has supernatural powers, but supernature is kind of pasted on these individuals, and strange things do happen.
Well, and you tell about strange things that happened long before you were in the public eye. What was it like to grow up in Beirut in the 50s and 60s?
Well, that seemed very unstrange at the time because there was civil wars going on at various times. But when the wars were not going on, we all wanted to be teenagers back in the States where the cool stuff was happening. And we only got like an hour a day of the Voice of America playing pop music. And I think the BBC World Service had another hour a week. And we'd all hover over the radio to catch that, to try and live normal teenage lives. You know, the American school in Beirut would stage Sadie Hawkins dances, but none of us really knew how to do it.
So you must have felt as though you, as teenagedom took over and the sort of pop youthquake started happening, you must have felt like you were missing it.
That's right. We were missing it. We had other mundane things. One of my buddy's friends turned out to be a Russian double agent. It wasn't until I was in college later that my own dad turned out to be a spy, at least for the right side.
So your father, you discovered, the reason you were in Beirut was because he was in the CIA.
And in fact, my daddy and his amoral crew did things that are, by today's standards, quite heinous, you know, replacing governments and so on. You know, regime change was just sort of a day's work back then. Their job was to make sure that the Arab oil flowed to the west, to us, to Detroit, and not north to the Soviets.
How old were you when you discovered this amazing fact about your father?
I was in college in California, and it was during the exposure of the CIA crimes in Latin America.
Uh-huh.
And I remember thinking, really? But my dad is such a genial, cool guy. And people would say to me, how can you love your father?
Your father, before he was a CIA agent, was a musician.
Yes, he was a jazz musician before the war. He played trumpet.
For Glenn Miller.
Yes, among others. Although that was a blot on his career as far as he was concerned. That was like having played for, I don't know, the Jonas Brothers or something. so he downplayed that while bragging about it, of course.
Uh-huh. Tell me about how and when you started drumming.
Well, I'm not sure how or why it happened, but it just happened. I was that kid who's always tapping on something, mostly my knees and my toes banging on the ground. And then I got a drum and drove my family insane. And I discovered that there was a use to all this banging and mm-hmm. clattering, which is when I played in my first band at the American Embassy Beach Club in Beirut. And there's Janet McRoberts, one of the 15-year-old girls, like actually responding and looking with lust upon this, you know, like I was a late bloomer.
Wow.
And I could see that banging, you know, hitting the beat and holding the rhythm was actually making all those people dance. That's pretty intoxicating.
Yes, yes. You eventually ended up in California, and I'd love it if you could read a little from the book about this period of your life.
Sure. This is one of the tame parts here.
You know, we got the FCC.
1973, college. So it turns out that I'm kind of a foreigner here, too. I'm getting used to being the guy in differently shaped jeans. Every other day, I head downtown to the San Diego School of Performing Arts for piano time and composition classes. The music department takes up the bottom half of the stately old building. Dr. Mary Kay Phillips is at the piano playing our homework. All of us geeks are twitching as she points out the mistakes of voicing and spelling. The focus of the group is the mechanics of harmony. The other student pieces sound like they're supposed to sound, like pale Mozart, and no one seems to mind that they're meaningless sequences of chords. The point is to grasp the laws of harmonic movement. When she gets to my piece, she plays it down like a breeze, and I'm basking in the beauty of hearing it for the first time as a listener, without having to limp through playing it myself. But I know she will crush me with the inevitable technical errors. When she reaches the end, the room is unusually silent. She turns to me and says, "Stuart, you have parallel fifths in measure 3, 7, and 11, but more important, this is actual music. You have a voice." Well, that may seem like faint praise, but it puffed me right up. Some part of the feverish, grandiose exaltation that I get from my own music is actually discernible to a dispassionate ear. Some part of the voodoo actually works. She was right about those 16 bars that I wrote for her homework assignment. They stuck in my head and eventually even reached my fingers. I could play that string of expertly voiced chords together with a scrap of lyric and a few years later record it with the Police. The song was called "Does Everyone Stare the Way I Do?" I imagine the royalties from just that one song, flagged by Dr. Mary Kay Phillips, must have paid off all my years of music education.
You were lucky to have Dr. Phillips.
I was. She's still there, 80-something, down in San Diego.
In that song, "Does Everyone Stare," was on the Police's second album, Regatta de Blanc. How did white reggae, so-called, come to define the sound of the Police?
Well, I suppose the expression white reggae is a lot sexier than ballady, which is actually where those rhythms came from, as far as I was concerned, which is the kind of dance they do in the hills of Lebanon. It's that ballady just means country. And the Arabic music that I grew up with, without even really listening to it, has a kind of lope to it that's very similar to reggae.
Huh.
It has the same use of negative space. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Ba-da-da. You know, it uses that hole to suck you in. And, of course, as soon as Stingo got hold of Bob Marley, that was like a real epiphany for him.
Stingo being your chronic name for your former partner, Sting.
Yeah. But there was another trend as well going on in those years in London, which was that at the punk clubs, and not many people are aware of this, but we started out as a fake punk band.
Uh-huh.
And then what we actually became from that point, we became a boy band, which I'd forgotten all about until I saw some of these pictures of us on the girly magazines. And it wasn't until years later that we were respected for our musical genius. But our first thing was as a boy band.
Right.
But back in the punk years in London, the punk clubs had this thrashing punk music, which was even giving the 18-year-olds a headache. And in most clubs, you got to mix it up. You need some chill music. So what the DJs discovered was obscure dub tracks of reggae, which had all the ingredients that the punks wanted, which was anger, revolution. But I think the first punk band to grab it was The Clash.
Uh-huh.
And we, like the whole punk scene, the Police came along. We were 4 or 5 years older and could actually play our instruments. We were the big kids on the playground, and we just said, "Oh, that candy you're playing with, we'll take that." In fact, their punk song that they did was called "Police and Thieves." So it's kind of poetic that the Police came along and stole their trick. You know, I discovered Sting. Andy discovered the two of us. He was a real high-class triple-scale guitarist. We could have never afforded such a guy. And we happened to be on a session, and he pulls me into a cafe, and he says, "Stuart, you and that bass player guy, I think you got something. But you need me in the band. I accept." Well, Andy didn't take Andy long to figure out the up chick on the guitar.
Right.
I guess Roxanne was our first kind of reggae tune, but it wasn't reggae at all.
Roxanne, you don't have to put on the red light. Those days are over. You don't have to sell your body to the night. Roxanne.
So to get that kind of feel, there is a conscious decision to move the rhythm one quarter note to the right. so the backbeat lands on 3 instead of 2 and 4. And by the way, any of your listeners, any budding drummers out there want to set the world on fire and have your face on the front cover of Drum World magazine? 1 beat to the left is still available.
How do you think your life would have gone differently if you'd never met Stingo?
It's hard to say. I would like to think that I would have conquered the world myself, gosh darn it. But who knows? We are somehow joined psychically, emotionally. We are like brothers. And when we were younger, we tore each other to shreds. And now we understand that that dichotomy is sort of what makes the band what it is. If it wasn't Sting telling me to shut up every now and then, it would just be a banging, clattering noise. And if it wasn't me telling him to wake up every now and then, it would just be a string of ballads. I used to like to joke that Sting was like the father I never had. The father I did have was supportive, kindly, genial.
Stuart Copeland, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Stuart Copeland's memoir is called Strange Things Happen. And you can hear a lot more about his rich creative life after the Police at studio360.org. And coming up in a minute, we'll take a look inside the Disney hit machine.
People say, oh, it's such a simple song. But it isn't simple. It's a world of laughter and a world of tears. It's a world of hopes and a world of fears. There's so much that we share that it's time we're aware. It's a small world after all.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.